Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 116, Here Come the Illyrians. As I said at the end of the last episode, the assassination of Gallienus in 268 marked the beginning of the end for the crisis of the 3rd century. In the 33 years since the death of Alexander Severus, the Roman Empire had been on a pretty impressive downhill slide. Emperors were dropping like flies, barbarians were running amok, the empire had broken in three, disease and famine were rampant. But inch by inch and mile by mile, the successors of Gallienus are about to pull Rome out of its skid and put it back on top of the geopolitical food chain. These successors were notable not just for their achievements, but also for the fact that they all hailed from the same part of the empire. Though I usually refer to the third phase of the crisis period as the recovery phase, it could just as easily be known as the era of the Illyrian emperors. If anyone out there is still clinging to the notion that the Roman Empire fell because it stopped being a Roman Empire, well, I can promise you that it would have fallen a whole lot earlier had it not been for the succession of native Illyrians who pulled Rome out of the ditch that it had driven itself into. Claudius, Aurelian, Probus, Diocletian, Constantine, these are the men who salvaged an empire that looked like it was headed straight for the dustbin of history. The Roman Empire wasn't a Roman Empire anymore, and it was a good thing for the Romans that it wasn't. Despite his impressive-sounding name, Marcus Aurelius Valerius Claudius most likely had no aristocratic connections anywhere in his family tree. His origins are too obscure to say definitively, but like other young men from the Danube frontier who joined the legions, he probably came from peasant stock and was looking for a ticket to a better life that service in the army sometimes provided. Usually, it provided hardship, suffering, and an early death, but to the youths of Pannonia and Moesia, that can't have sounded too different from the lives they could expect to lead staying at home. At least in the legions, there was an outside chance you might get promoted to centurion or something, and pick up a few cash bonuses along the way. Born around 213, Claudius and his fellows would have entered the legions in the early 230s, and though we know these years as the moment when the empire slipped into crisis mode, for the common soldier, these were the years when, really, anything became possible. A legionary who showed courage, discipline, and who kept his wits about him in the heat of battle was likely to find himself not just in charge of a cohort, but a whole legion. And, after the ascension of Maximinus Thrax, maybe even the whole empire. Claudius was courageous and disciplined and kept his wits about him in the heat of battle, and so he slowly climbed up the ranks. He had the further good fortune of coming into his own during the reign of Gallienus, when legions run by career military men, rather than the usual gang of aristocratic social climbers, was becoming the rule, rather than the exception. Claudius seems to have excelled everywhere he went, and as Aureolus faded as Gallienus's favorite general, Claudius stepped in and became one of the emperor's most trusted military advisors. When Aureolus was stripped of the all-important cavalry command, Claudius was quite literally handed the reins. Claudius's role in the assassination of Gallienus the next year has never been fully ascertained, but no one doubts that he was at least aware of the plot. Constantine's revisionist historians attempted to absolve Claudius of all guilt, but their claims are far-fetched to say the least. As the senior ranking general of the officer corps, he was not only the natural choice to succeed Gallienus, but also a man whose at least tacit consent would have been required for a plot to move forward. On a more personal level, he was also the senior ranking Illyrian, and it was native Illyrian officers who were the prime movers in the plot to remove Gallienus. To think that Claudius did not know what his friends and countrymen were up to strains credulity. When the deed was done, the conspirators arranged for the men to proclaim Claudius emperor, and he accepted, no doubt feigning surprise. Having assumed power by way of a coup, though, Claudius was quick to distance himself from the assassins and promote the legacy of Gallienus. In stark contrast to the rewards they were probably expecting, Claudius singled out a number of the officers behind the plot to kill Gallienus and had them executed or exiled. The new emperor wanted the world to know that he did not approve of regicide, especially since he was now the rege who could possibly be cited. To further distance himself from the conspiracy, when Claudius traveled to Rome to cement his new powers, he took the surprising step of demanding that the Senate deify Gallienus. The Senate, of course, balked at this. Far from wanting to deify Gallienus, when Claudius's order came down, they were preparing to vote to damn his memory, a la Domitian. Forced to swallow their pride, which is of course what had made them so mad at Gallienus in the first place, the Senate instead voted to deify him, as Claudius instructed. His hands now relatively clean, Claudius took stock of the empire he had inherited. In the West, the Gallic Empire was still in the hands of Postumus, and looking as strong as ever. Despite being solidly separatist, though, the Gallic provinces maintained a non-aggressive attitude towards Rome, so, for the time being, they could wait. In the East, Odoenathus' death had led to the rise of his widow Zenobia. There was definitely something that needed to be done about that. It was one thing for the East to be run by Odoenathus, but his wife, this latter-day Cleopatra? No, that wouldn't do at all. What if she decided to do something crazy like take over Egypt? No, the East needed to be brought back under imperial control and fast. But Zenobia too would have to wait. After all, had they not all just been involved in staving off a massive Gothic invasion when Aureolus had decided to revolt? Was that invasion even over yet? No? Well, that is going then to have to be priority A1. So, after spending a few months in Rome, Claudius ordered the troops in Milan back to the Danube, where either loose Goths from the previous invasion were still running around, or a whole new invasion force had come in, depending on which theory you buy into about the Gothic invasion patterns of the late 260s AD. Well, that is, he headed over to the Danube directly from Rome, as long as you believe that one particular theory about Claudius' movements during his 18-month reign. I happen to believe that theory, so that's the version of the story we're going with, but just so you know, there is another theory that has Claudius dealing with the penetration of an Alemanni horde into northern Italy before he went to the Danube to face the Goths at Nisus, but this just doesn't seem logical to me from the Alemanni's point of view. The theory I happen to believe is that Claudius went to the Danube, fought the Goths at Nisus, and while he was busy, the Germans made their move, and Claudius was forced to return to Italy to deal with them. To argue that the Alemanni invaded right away means arguing that they decided to charge headlong into an imperial army still encamped outside Milan, which maybe they did, but it just doesn't seem practical. Better to wait until the Romans withdraw the bulk of their forces back to the Danube, right? That seems like the savvy play. So Claudius marched the imperial army back to the Balkans, where the withdrawal of Gallienus the previous year had left the Danube provinces open to further Gothic attack. Scholars have gone back and forth about whether the threat Claudius rode off to face represented a continuation of the previous invasion, or whether the Goths had abandoned Roman territory, regrouped, and were now launching a second invasion. If there was a second invasion, it followed very closely the route taken in 267, with a massive Gothic fleet heading down the Black Sea coast, passing into the Sea of Marmara, and from there into the Aegean, sacking and pillaging all along the way. When Claudius entered the Balkans, a Gothic horde, that is, women and children along with the men, possibly 100,000 strong, was loose in the mainland. The Romans and Goths met outside the city of Nisus, and though we don't know the size of the army Claudius led, the Goths are said to have fielded an army somewhere north of 50,000 men. The battle that followed was an extremely hard-fought affair, but showing off that old Roman discipline, the Goths were finally broken when Claudius pulled the old fake a retreat, then whirl around and smash your surprised opponent trick. a trick likely led by his new cavalry commander, Lucius Domitius Aurelianus. The Goths were mostly killed or captured, but even a victory as great as the one at Nisus was not decisive. A sizable contingent of the Goths managed to break free and push west into Macedonia. Claudius wheeled his army around and caught the survivors trying to fortify themselves behind their own carts. When Claudius broke through these defenses, the Goths once again took flight, but as they had no provisions to speak of, the chase itself was taking more of a toll on their remaining numbers than the Romans were. They finally holed up on the side of a mountain and found themselves immediately besieged and trapped. Disease and famine ripped through the Gothic ranks, and the chiefs quickly determined that they would not survive like this for very long. So they broke out again, and amazingly enough, the starving and exhausted Goths managed to penetrate the Roman line and point themselves towards home. But the final battle took too much out of them, and the last of the last survivors were quickly tracked down by the Roman cavalry, and with no strength left to fight, they gave up. The fate of these surviving Goths might surprise you, but the circumstances of the times demanded that the Romans break out of the old enslave and annex routine that had served them so well for so long. The combination of disease and famine, near constant warfare and economic upheaval, had left the empire, and particularly the Danube provinces, overworked and undermanned. So Claudius decided to initiate a policy that had been used occasionally in the past, but never in any sort of systemic way. He settled these conquered Goths inside the Roman Empire. This had the effect of eliminating them as a foreign threat, putting them to work to boost the Roman economy rather than suck it dry, and provide a new recruiting ground for the legions. For their part, the Goths were more than happy to be allowed entrance into this rich land that they had for so long coveted. Their brothers and sisters back north of the Danube were sure to take note of this shift in policy, though they would be well advised to also note that only defeated barbarians are allowed the privilege of Roman settlement. As we go forward, this policy of resettlement and enrollment of the able-bodied men into the legions will become standard imperial policy and serve as one of the key strategies employed to maintain peace in the borderlands. It should always be remembered that the massive defeat, for example, at Adrianople was caused not because the Goths were led into the empire by Valens, but instead because the migration was so badly mismanaged. As with most of Rome's victories these days, there was not long to savor the win at Nisus. After a 10-year hiatus, the Alemanni got the band back together again and decided to launch a comeback tour through northern Italy. The presumption is that after their defeat near Milan around 260, the Germans felt that they had made a peace deal between themselves and Gallienus without necessarily recognizing the Roman state itself as a party to the negotiations. So, when Gallienus died, well, that meant that it was now open season on Rome again. My assumption is that they waited for Claudius to withdraw back to the Danube before they made their move, but it could very well be that they invaded the minute that they heard the emperor was dead. Whatever the order of events, the outcome was the same. Claudius and his imperial army swept in and crushed the Alemanni at Lake Benicus. The reported numbers have it that Claudius needed just 35,000 troops to kill or capture half of the 100,000 men of the Alemanni army, which would be a stunning victory to say the least. But the enemy numbers probably refer to the whole Alemanni contingent, not just the fighting men, so it is likely that the battle itself was evenly matched. Regardless, Claudius sent the Germans running home and established himself as basically the greatest thing to happen to Rome in a long, long time. In the span of just a few months, he had wiped the floor with the Goths, and then the Germans, and proved to the world that when it needed it, Rome still had it. Best of all was the fact that Claudius was leading the legions to all these victories personally, So there was no repeat of the whole victorious general gets proclaimed emperor dynamic that had kept dividing the empire immediately after its victories in the field. Rome's foreign enemies were knocked back on their heels enough that the emperor could begin thinking about the real prize, the reunification of the empire. Though the situation in the East was essentially the same as when he took office the year before, the situation in the West had changed dramatically. Posthumus was dead, killed by his own troops, and the political stability of the Gallic Empire was in serious doubt. Posthumus had been followed briefly on the throne by a man with the auspicious name Marcus Aurelius Marius, but his reign had been measured in days, and the western provinces were now being controlled by a noble named Victorinus, backed by the deep pockets of his mother, Victoria. Only, the western provinces Victorinus controlled were not the same as the western provinces that Posthumus had controlled. The Iberian Peninsula took the death of Posthumus as an opportunity to reconcile with Rome, and they switched their allegiance to Claudius, leaving Victorinus with only Gaul and Britain as his domains. So, after defeating the Alemanni, Claudius peeled off a good chunk of his army, handed it over to a lieutenant, with instructions to see how much more of the Gallic Empire could be brought back into the Roman fold. The answer was not all of it, as Claudius probably hoped, but was instead the not insignificant most of the Rhone Valley. It was progress, and Claudius no doubt looked forward to being remembered as the man who restored the empire. He left this important mission to a lieutenant because in mid-269, a new player in our game began to mass on the Danube border, looking like they were looking for trouble. The Vandals. As with the Goths, the true origins of the tribe that became known as the Vandals is obscure, but most scholars agree that they came from somewhere in Scandinavia and were settled northeast of the region between the Danube and Rhine rivers by the first centuries BC, far enough off from the empire that they were not major players in the early imperial battles against their German neighbors, though it is recorded that Marcus Aurelius made a separate peace with them during the Marcomannic Wars, as he was looking to isolate the tribes from each other. During the population shifts of the 3rd century, though, they found themselves pressing up against the borders of the empire, and, likely hearing of the success the Goths were having, they decided to take a crack at Rome themselves. Claudius and the rest of his army made for Sirmium, the capital of Lower Pannonia, which the emperor planned to make his headquarters during the coming offensive against the Vandals. But, if you listen closely to the section when I introduce the Cyprian Plague, you know how this story ends. In January 270, Claudius, who would shortly become known to history as Claudius Gothicus for his great victory at Nisus, came down with the plague, and he died. He was 56 years old, and had ruled the empire for just about 18 months. Though his short reign was defined by military success against Rome's foreign enemies, Claudius's most enduring legacy was the cabal of Illyrian officers he brought with him to the forefront of imperial politics. Most of the major military commands were now in the hands of his countrymen, and for the next generation, these Illyrian generals would dominate the Roman Empire. Culminating in the reigns of Diocletian and Constantine, the Illyrian emperors breathed new life into a Roman empire that had been at death's door. True, it would be a different empire that emerged on the other side, but it would still be an intact empire, and that was what counted. Antiquity was not dead yet. Claudius had been so consumed by his labors, though, that he never stopped to worry about the little matter of who would succeed him when he died. So, when he did die, the question was still hanging out there. As had happened when Decius died in the swamps of Abritus, the Senate had one idea about who ought to rule, and the army had another. But there would be no generous concord between these rival choices, as there had been between Gallus and Hostilian. 20 years of additional non-stop warfare had made the Senate beyond irrelevant, and ignoring them would not really introduce any sort of significant discord into the mix. As long as the armies were of one mind, the possibility of civil war was low, and the armies were of one mind. They wanted Aurelian. Back in Rome, the Senate elevated Claudius's brother Quintilius, but he never stood a chance, and neither Aurelian nor his legions were too much worried about what the Senate thought about anything. Lucius Domitius Aurelianus had been born around 215 in the province of Pannonia to a tenant farmer of absolutely no consequence. He was just a few years younger than Claudius, and so, like the now dead emperor, Aurelian came of age just as the crisis of the 3rd century was heating up, and he thus spent his entire career embroiled in one war after another, and rising up through the ranks every time a vacancy opened up, which, during the tumultuous mid-200s AD, was often. By the time of Gallienus's assassination, Aurelian was one of the top two or three generals in the empire, closely associated with Claudius and the other Illyrian officers who had taken over the high command of the legions. Known by the nickname Hand on Hilt, or Sword in Hand, Aurelian was known for being tough, humorless, disciplined, and focused. He tolerated no fools, and likely would have been as hated an officer as the legions could spit out, were he not also fantastically talented and virtually unbeatable in the field. He took over command of the mobile cavalry when Claudius became emperor, and ran them against the Goths at Nisus, leading the offensive that initially broke the invaders, and then leading the pursuit that finished them off. He was unquestionably the number two man in the empire during the reign of Claudius, and when the emperor succumbed to the plague in early 270, there was no doubt in the army's mind who should replace him. Old Sword in Hand. They could not have chosen a better man for the job that lay ahead. When Aurelian assumed the purple in 270, the empire was not only still divided from itself, but in the east, Zenobia was making moves that signaled she had no intention of ever being brought back into the Roman fold. Perhaps as early as the last few months of Claudius's reign, Zenobia had ordered the Palmyrene army to enter Egypt and occupy Alexandria. At no point had Gallienus ever granted Odenathus access to Egypt, let alone hegemony over it, and Zenobia's move was nothing less than an act of war. The make-or-break point had come in the relationship between East and West, and the new Emperor Aurelian was absolutely dedicated with every fiber of his being to making sure that it did not break. Next week, Old Sword in Hand will begin his remarkable 5-year run on the throne, during which, step by step and day by day, he will refuse the bonds that held the empire together. The golden age of Rome was long dead. This was an age of iron, and Aurelian was a man of iron. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 117, Aurelian's Walls. During the big-time question blowout that was the 100th episode of the History of Rome, I listed my top 5 emperors as being Augustus, Diocletian, Trajan, Constantine, and Hadrian. This is a pretty conventional list, and apart from ordering and maybe subbing in Marcus Aurelius for someone, it's not going to cause much controversy. But one assumption that I made when putting the list together was that we were talking about career value rather than peak value. An obvious similarity between all the guys in my top 5 is that they each ruled for a long, long time. Trajan put in the shortest service time of the 5 and he still ruled for more than 19 years. You can make a big impact when you have 20 or more years to work with, and so it should come as no surprise that my greatest emperors are also some of the longest-serving emperors. But that's true as long as we're talking about greatest in terms of career value. See, when we sit around and debate who was the greatest pitcher of all time, or who was the greatest goalie of all time, or who was the greatest golfer of all time, we always need to make sure that everyone is on the same page. Are we talking about career value, or are we talking about peak value? That is, are we talking about the guy who did the most, scored the most, blocked the most, won the most of all time, or the guy who, at his peak, in his prime, was simply the best of the best? Maybe his career was cut short by injury, or he hit a wall when he turned 30 or whatever, but for a while, he was unhittable, undefendable, and unstoppable. Being the baseball fan that I am, I know the patron saint of peak value as Dodger pitcher Sandy Koufax. You will not see his name on the lists of most strikeouts all time, or most wins all time, or most innings of all time. But he put together five of the most dominant seasons that anyone has ever seen in the history of baseball. From 1962 to 1966, Sandy Koufax was the left hand of God, and his single season statistics during this period are absolutely mind-boggling. I'm going to stop now so I don't spend the rest of the episode gushing about Sandy Koufax, and really, this is just a very roundabout way of saying that Lucius Domitius Aurelianus may not have been around long enough to accumulate the kind of all-time stats you need to crack into the top of the emperor's career value list. But from 270 to 275, oh man, he was peak value defined. If you sometimes have trouble remembering which emperor was which during the 3rd century and what happened during whose reign, just remember that Aurelian is the Sandy Koufax of Roman emperors. The rest, hopefully, should fall into place. Aurelian was in Thrace, serving as the captain of the mobile cavalry and doing advanced work for the coming campaign against the Vandals when Claudius died of the Cyprian plague in 270 AD. It did not take long for the officers of the imperial army to track down the dead emperor's second-in-command and offer him supreme authority over the legions and, by extension, the empire. Back in Italy, though, a word of Claudius' death immediately fired up the ambitions of a man by the name of Marcus Aurelius Claudius Quintilis, the younger brother of the dead emperor. Despite their frequent protests to the contrary, the Romans were as much enamored with blood ties as anyone else, and as he took over the role of paterfamilias from his brother, Quintilis had an eye on taking over the role of emperor as well. Now, everyone and their mother knew that the Danube legions were going to turn to Aurelian, and there were many in the aristocracy who feared the ascension of old Sword in Hand, the no-nonsense soldier, who would likely have little room at his table for the Senate, who, let's face it, were chock-full of nonsense. So they decided to back Quintilis's bid for the throne. And though the Danube legions were far and away the best of the legions, Quintilis, by virtue of his relation to Claudius, had been put in charge of the significant Italian garrisons, which included the Praetorian Guard, so it's not like his bid was backed by nothing but the Senate's hot air. Unfortunately for Quintilis, though, the Danube legions really were the best of the best, and they made his Italian army look like it was, well, made of little more than hot air. Aurelian accepted the acclamation of the legions, and upon becoming emperor, well, one claimant anyway, his first move was to turn the armies around and march them back to Italy to establish his authority over the home province. It was not an auspicious beginning to his reign, as he fell into the same trap that so many other 3rd century emperors had fallen into, leading the legions away from the frontier to consolidate power right at the moment when they were needed on the borders to consolidate victory. Claudius had put his foot into the backsides of both the Alemanni and the Goths, and a concentrated push against the remaining northern tribes might re-establish Roman power for a generation or more. With Claudius dead, though, that all now appeared to be in jeopardy. But Aurelian managed to smash his way out of the trap, rather than falling by the wayside like Decius and Aemilianus and Gallus before him. The northern tribes would take advantage of his withdrawal back to Italy, but they would come to regret it. Quintilius gathered his troops at Aquileia in preparation for the assumed invasion of Aurelian, but as they met and readied themselves, it became obvious quickly that this was starting to look an awful lot like a suicide mission. Eventually, the Danube legions, under the command of Aurelian, are going to come pouring down out of the Alpine passes. And then what are we going to do? Defeat them in battle? I don't think so. Accounts differ as to the fate of Quintilius, that is, whether he was killed by his own troops or committed suicide, but they don't differ in having him dead as a doornail when Aurelian arrived in Italy. The troops Quintilius had gathered, needless to say, swore allegiance to Aurelian the first chance they got. As with everything else to do with the 3rd century, the chronology of Aurelian's reign is very confused. And though we know the things that he did, we cannot hope to know exactly the order in which he did them. Right off the bat, though, it seems that he headed back to the Balkans because the Vandals had taken his withdrawal of the legions as an open invitation to attack. The Vandals already posed enough of a threat that they were next up on Claudius's hit list when he died, and the disappearance of the imperial army only inflamed their passions. And before you could say the emperor is dead, long live the emperor, the Vandals were running amok in Pannonia. So after making sure Quintilius was dead and the troops in Italy were with him, Aurelian immediately charged back to the Balkans to push back the invading tribes. Aurelian's strategy for dealing with the Vandals was to order that anything that could be consumed by men and horse be drawn inside the towns and cities of the provinces to leave the invading Vandals without anything to eat. Once the lack of provisions began to drag the Vandals down, Aurelian swept in and crushed them in a quick battle. When the fighting was done, Aurelian allowed the remaining Vandals to return home, but with the stipulation that they hand over 2,000 cavalrymen to serve in the Roman army. With internal recruitment often coming up dry as a result of 20 years of famine, plague, and warfare, Aurelian knew that fresh recruits for his army were going to have to come from somewhere if he planned to reunify the empire, and the German tribes began to look like an excellent source of soldiers. The Vandal horsemen would not be the last or even the largest levy Aurelian would lay on defeated northern tribes, and it was during his reign that the so-called Germanization of the legions, already underway in the form of temporary auxiliaries and sometime mercenaries, would really begin in earnest. On an ad hoc basis, the empire had always been able to get tribes from beyond the frontiers to fight for them, going back as far as Julius Caesar, but the process was about to become far more systematized and far more permanent. While he was overseeing the Vandal retreat, though, word came that the Alemanni, or likely just the Jathungi, one of their component tribes, was headed into Italy. The third time now in just over 10 years that barbarians had set foot on the once perfectly safe peninsula of Italy. Leaving behind enough troops to remind the Vandals of their oath, Aurelian headed back to Italy, a trip that was becoming a nearly annual pilgrimage for the men of the Danube legions. When they reached the peninsula, Aurelian found that the Jathungi had overrun the Po Valley, sacked a number of towns, and were presently occupying the key city of Placentia. Aurelian made straight for the city, but in his haste to meet the enemy, he never gave his men time to rest, and when they finally arrived at Placentia, the legionaries were exhausted. Well, actually, that's not true. They never even reached the city. The Jathungi had set an ambush for the Romans, and right at sunset, the weary legions were ready to make camp and go to bed. But the Germans sprang out of the woods and put Aurelian and his army to a humiliating flight. Scattered and disoriented, it took some time to piece the legions back together, and in the meantime, the Jathungi pointed themselves south, aiming directly for Rome, which understandably put the Romans into a panic. The ambush at Placentia, though, was by no means a decisive victory for the Jathungi. and the embarrassment it caused Aurelian only ratcheted up his motivation to stop them. He regrouped his forces and gave chase, this time keeping a close eye on the Jathungai's movements and waiting for the right moment to strike. He found his moment on the banks of the Metaurus River, where he broadsided the Germans and ran them into the water, which swept a good number of them down to a watery grave. The battered Jathungai sent word to the Emperor that they would like to parley for peace and safe passage home. But their attitude was not sufficiently deferential for Aurelian, and he rejected their entreaties. Without a guarantee of safe passage, the Germans were forced to head north, with Aurelian's army shadowing their movements and waiting again for the perfect opportunity to smash them up for good. This time, the opportunity came at Pava, where Aurelian forced the fleeing Jathungai into a pitched battle that they had no hope of winning. Completely defeated, the remaining Germans surrendered their captured booty and begged for mercy, which this time Aurelian allowed, if they gave their fighting men over to the legions. If they wanted to live, they'd have to fight for the empire, not against it. Some reports have this new influx of soldiers coming in at anywhere between 20 and 40,000 men. This was not small potatoes to an imperial army badly weakened by the previous generation's strife. With the frontiers finally quieted down a bit and Italy free of invaders, Aurelian was finally able to make his triumphal entry into Rome in early 271, almost a year into his reign. Sporting the new title Germanicus Maximus for his recent victories, it is likely that Aurelian was expecting, if not enthusiastic greetings from the citizens of Rome, then at least a warm embrace. But Aurelian's entry into the city seems to have actually sparked riots and street fighting not seen since the days of the Flavian capture of Rome some 200 years before. The causes for this mass uprising were threefold. First, there was the lingering effects of the panic caused by Aurelian's defeat at Placentia, which had everyone's nerves good and frayed. Second was the disruption of the grain supply, which likely had been caused by Zenobia's capture of Egypt. And third, we have the massive fraud being undertaken daily at the main imperial mint in Rome, which is the reason the riots got started in the first place. As I mentioned a few episodes back, debasement of the coinage was a major problem for the Roman economy, and the damage done by official imperial policy was being hugely exacerbated by the conduct of the workers at the mint when it came time to actually produce the debased coins. Even the nominal amount of silver that was supposed to be going into the coins was having a hard time finding its way into circulation, and instead kept getting routed into the pockets of the workers and administrators of the mint, and, of course, the pockets of any official tasked with overseeing the process. Aurelian had already signaled that he planned to revalue the coins back up to a respectable level, respectable for the times being 5% silver in the denarius, and the mint workers were justifiably worried that when Aurelian found out that their additional graft was making things even worse than he thought, that he would be, well, displeased. And given Aurelian's fearsome reputation, displeased meant that heads were likely to roll, literally. So when Aurelian arrived in Rome, the mint workers took to the streets and began demonstrating against the new regime. Soon enough, they had ginned up their narrowly selfish cause into a general strike, and full-blown street riots broke out, egged on by senators and equites who had backed Quintilius and who hoped to drive Aurelian out of power before he had a chance to do any damage to their interests. Angry at the sedition and unwavering in his commitment to putting down the mob, Aurelian called in regular troops to back up the urban cohorts who were clashing daily with the enraged citizenry. Thousands were dying on both sides, but pretty soon, order was restored as the overmatched civilians were driven back into their homes. When the full story of how the mint riots got started came out, the citizens of Rome found Aurelian had passed well beyond displeased. A quick and ruthless purge followed that took the lives not just of the mint administrators, but also the senators and equites who had supported first their fraud and then their riots. When Aurelian's harsh justice was done being meted out, the emperor then took the unprecedented step of simply closing the Rome Mint down for good. Though this extraordinary measure was undertaken specifically because Aurelian did not feel that he could now trust Rome to implement his reformist monetary policies, it had the effect of being one of the final nails in the coffin of Rome's political and economic relevance. A decade later, Diocletian would be able to come to power and avoid visiting the Eternal City for 19 years without any serious repercussions. But though Rome's practical power was waning, its power as a symbolic force was still immense. Even Diocletian could not deny that. And the recent string of Italian invasions had gotten Aurelian and his fellow officers thinking about how best to protect the living embodiment of the empire. For more than 200 years, the defensive strategy that had been invented by Augustus and brought to full realization by Hadrian had worked just fine. Post legionary garrisons on the frontiers, build walls to control cross-border movement, and focus militarily and politically on keeping the Rhine and Danube tribes divided from one another. For generation after generation, the strategy had worked out as well as anyone could have hoped, and with the frontier garrisons easily absorbing whatever foreign encroachments came along, there was little reason to worry about maintaining the local defenses of the towns and cities in the interior. But times had changed. Squeezed between Rome on one side and rising eastern powers like the Huns on the other, and we'll get to them soon enough, the German tribes were now well down the road towards regional unification, which rendered the old divide-and-conquer technique obsolete. It also meant that the various legionary garrisons now faced enemy numbers far in excess of anything that they had had to face before or were equipped to handle. It used to be that a legion or three could stop up any leak with ease, but now torrents of Germans in the hundreds of thousands were blowing past the completely outnumbered garrisons with impunity. Compounding this problem was the fact that, for domestic political reasons, emperors could no longer afford to place the kind of troop numbers necessary to combat these supersized invasion forces under the command of some random general. If a general had enough troops to face down the Alemanni or the Goths, then he had enough troops to steal the throne. Gallienus had recognized this problem and made sure that he was always at the head of the most massive army the empire could put together, complete with its totally dominant mobile cavalry. But that meant that wherever this great imperial army wasn't, well, that is where the Germans would be. For Gallienus and then Claudius and now Aurelian, this meant an awful lot of rushing around trying to expel invaders after they had already invaded. In terms of grand strategy, it meant that the Romans had completely lost the initiative, which, yeah, was bad, but on a purely practical level, it really meant that the great cities of the empire, including Rome, were now completely vulnerable to attack. That the imperial army would maybe be able to arrive next month and try to reclaim the captured goods from some raid and punish the raiders usually came as cold comfort to the citizens of the raided city. If the outer walls of the empire, those built by Domitian and Hadrian, were no longer enough to keep foreign invasion at bay, then the empire needed new walls. Walls that would allow communities to stave off defeat until the imperial army could arrive and drive the invaders off. What the empire needed was city walls. On their own initiative, many cities near the frontiers had already upgraded their defensive walls. But Aurelian now put the imperial stamp of approval on the idea of permanently fortified cities by ordering a massive wall circuit built around Rome itself. As Rome's power had grown, so too had the city grown, and the old Servian walls, built in the aftermath of the Gallic sack way back in the 4th century BC, had ceased to function as any sort of real defensive barrier. The majority of the city now lay beyond its scope. And for essentially the entire imperial period, Rome was an unwalled city, and one so far from the front lines that no one gave it another thought. Now, they were thinking about it all the time. During his brief stay in Rome in 271, Aurelian wasted no time sketching out plans for a new fortification circuit that would include areas like, say, the Campus Martius, which once upon a time had been an empty field, but was now a bustling urban area that housed some of Rome's most important civic buildings, including the Pantheon and Pompey's Theater. The new wall circuit, eventually dubbed the Aurelian Walls for obvious reasons, would grow to be 19 kilometers long, and eventually enclose an area of 13.7 square kilometers. As originally built, the walls were 3.5 meters thick and 8 meters high, though in the 400s AD, when the going really got rough, the height was doubled to 16 meters. Every 100 Roman feet, there was a 26-meter-tall guard tower, so that eventually there were over 350 of these fortified towers looming over the city. In the end, there were 18 heavily defended main gates that limited access to the city, and 5 postern gates, which were essentially secret doors that allowed defenders to sneak in and out of the city without the enemy noticing. Because Aurelian's overriding concern was that the walls be completed as fast as possible, his engineers were ordered to incorporate as many existing buildings as possible into the design so as little new construction as possible would be needed. Normally, a project so overtly military as the Aurelian Walls would have been built by soldiers, but given the circumstances, Aurelian could not spare a single legionary, and he had to rely on civilian conscripts to do almost all the work, leading to irregularities in both the quality of the work and the aesthetic design of the different sections, as different crews worked double time to complete their designated zones. The whole circuit took just 5 years to complete, but even the record time Rome went from being naive and open to jaded and shut tight was too long for Aurelian, who died just before the last gaps were bridged. It was left to his successor Probus to formally dedicate the completed fortifications. I have posted some pictures at thehistoryofrome.typepad.com to give you an idea of the size and scope of these impressive new defense systems. The Aurelian Walls were solid proof that Rome was undergoing a permanent transformation. For centuries, the empire had been a bubble, with everyone living inside the bubble, nonchalantly coming and going without a care in the world. Now, that bubble was burst, and at any moment, a barbarian horde could come pouring in over the horizon. The ever-resilient Romans, though, had no intention of ceding their lives and territory simply because the old defensive lines were broken, and in place of the one huge bubble that they had lived in for so long, they built hundreds of tiny bubbles that dotted the provinces. When Aurelian built his walls around Rome, it was a signal to every other urban center to do the same. So now, though the barbarians were still able to cross the borders of the empire with ease, they would no longer find easy pickings on the other side when they did so. As the frontiers of the empire were reduced to mere theory, the Romans drew back the practical lines of defense right to their city limits. It was a strategic retreat that allowed Rome to regain the initiative. It said to the barbarians, "Okay, you're here, but now what are you going to do? We've hidden everything of value behind these walls, and you completely stink at siege warfare. Your move." Next week, Aurelian will make his next move. Confident that he had set the center of the empire on a path to true security, he cast his sights on the great prize that had been dancing just out of Rome's reach for the last decade, the reunification of her empire. Zenobia's capture of Egypt was absolutely unacceptable, and despite the official partnership that existed between Rome and Palmyra, there was no doubt that the two powers were now headed towards war. Aurelian planned to not just initiate the final conflict, but to win it outright. Palmyra would be laid low, and the East would be brought back into the empire. Of this, Aurelian had absolutely no doubt. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome. Episode 118, The Palmyrene Wars. Ever since the death of her husband in 267, the Palmyrene queen Zenobia had shown herself to be a formidable new player in the great game of power politics. In an age where every soldier was a potential emperor and every territory a potential new kingdom, Zenobia had not only held on to the power and land she had inherited from Odenathus, but little by little, she managed to expand upon it. The power and prestige of Rome was at an all-time low, and Zenobia was taking full advantage of the Eternal City's eclipse. She was shrewd and ambitious and capable, and had the ball of fate bounced this way instead of that, she might just have permanently severed Rome's claim to the East. Empires evolved and devolved all the time, and by Zenobia's estimation, the sun was setting on Rome's almost 350 years of dominance over the Eastern Mediterranean. Standing between Zenobia and a new independent Palmyrene empire, though, was an Illyrian emperor named Aurelian, who, like his brother officers, was obsessed with the idea of reuniting the empire. It had become their almost religious mission in life, and nothing was going to stop them, certainly not some Oriental queen. Consumed as he was with Germanic invasions and riots in Rome, though, Aurelian was at first unable to deal with said Oriental queen, even as she thumbed her nose at Roman authority. Probably upon receiving the news that Claudius was dead, Zenobia and her top general Zabdus had taken the opportunity to lead the Palmyrene army into Egypt, expel the Roman garrison, and occupy Alexandria. Whatever official or unofficial understanding existed between Rome and Palmyra, the status of Egypt was never in play. It was a Roman province to be held by a Roman prefect, duly appointed by a Roman emperor, just as it had been since the days of Augustus. In other words, her invasion of Egypt was way, way out of bounds. But, matching her own audacity in seizing Alexandria, Zenobia then pretended like nothing at all was amiss. After the brief power struggle following Claudius's death confirmed Aurelian was the new master of Rome, Zenobia dutifully issued coins from the Alexandrian mints, featuring Aurelian's name and image. True, the back of those coins featured the image of her young son Vibolithus, who, it should be recalled, Zenobia was ruling through, but her son was not presented as Augustus, as Aurelian clearly was. Further, official documents in the East were issued using letterhead that presented Aurelian's name first and Vibolithus as second. You see, nothing is amiss here. Rome and Palmyra are partners in power, and as is just and as is right, Rome is and will remain the senior and dominant partner. But while officially downplaying Palmyrene independence, Zenobia was clearly not planning to stop with the annexation of Egypt. The Palmyrene claims to the Eastern Empire had always been a weird mixture of personal prerogative and sanctioned super-authority, and as I mentioned a few episodes back, it is likely that the governance of Syria and its various municipalities had been left in the hands of the same local officials who had been running the show prior to the rise of Odenathus. Now Zenobia sought something a little more concrete. Working through agents and allies in the various cities of Syria, especially Antioch, she arranged for each in turn to begin the process of formally recognizing Palmyra as their political master. Through skillful diplomacy, Zenobia was able to secure direct control of Syria while avoiding the use of military force. Following up on this success, She initiated the same process in Asia Minor, and pretty soon, half of Anatolia had come around to recognizing Palmyra as their capital. These subtle power plays, though, were not lost on Aurelian. Zenobia could issue all the coins and declarations under Aurelian's name that she wished, but it was obvious that it was all so much kabuki. The alliance Gallienus had made with Odenathus had been born of a particular set of circumstances facing Rome at a time of emergency, and the mere fact of its perpetuation, now that the emergency had passed, was already a daily slap in the face to the proud officers of the Roman High Command. Zenobia's attempt to revise and extend the power of Palmyra was not just insulting then, it was an act of war. So in 271, Aurelian gathered up his imperial army and marched them out of Italy, beginning a journey that would eventually see them march all the way to the gates of Palmyra and back again, and then back to the gates of Palmyra. And I can tell you, when Aurelian has to go back the second time, he really, really isn't going to be happy about it. But before the legions could begin their march to the east in earnest, they had to settle the situation in the Balkans. And despite the fact that the invasions of their countrymen were now routinely ending in defeat at the hands of the legions, some Gothic tribes were still keen on the idea of raiding the empire for its wealth. So, as Aurelian reached the Danube frontier, he found the provinces once again littered with Gothic invaders. This batch, though, was nothing like the massive waves that had come down south in the 260s, indicating that Gothic power had been significantly affected by the previous decade's misadventures in Roman territory. But there were still enough of them on the loose to require Aurelian to stop short and deal with them. He was entirely successful in his efforts, and the Goths were driven back across the river. An interesting footnote to this brief Gothic campaign is that the tide of battle was turned when the Gothic king leading the invasion was killed. The sources have this Gothic king being named as some variation of Canabutus, which is similar enough phonetically to a certain Gothic king who, 20 years before, had destroyed the legions at Abritus and killed two emperors, to make some wonder if King Canabutus and King Caniva were not in fact the same person. If they were, then his death would have been sweet revenge for the Romans, much like Galerius's future capture of the Sassanid royal family will come as sweet revenge for the Persian imprisonment of Valerian. As concerned with the future security of the Danube frontier as he was with the future security of Rome, Aurelian likely took this moment to initiate his controversial plan to dramatically tighten up the Roman defensive line. The province of Dacia, sticking out like a sore thumb north of the Danube, had only avoided Hadrian's consolidation of Roman holdings some 150 years before because the blood, sweat, and tears that had gone into winning it was still fresh in everybody's mind. To give it up would have been an affront to the memories of those who had just fought and died to take it. So Hadrian was forced, against his better judgment, to leave it be. Also, it had some pretty sweet gold and silver mines. But the mines were dried up now, and in every way, Dacia was a lead weight around Rome's neck. It added over 500 miles to the military perimeter of the empire without offering any kind of strategic or tactical value in return. The mountainous province had never been colonized or Romanized properly, and, bottom line, hanging on to Dacia put the empire in greater danger than it needed to be in. The empire was already in great danger. It didn't need to be in greater danger. So Aurelian ordered the evacuation of the province. He was careful to make the process as steady and organized as possible. That is, he didn't just go around blaring a siren telling everybody to grab what they could and get out. But he made it very clear that in the near future, the order was going to come for the troops on the Dacian frontier to abandon their posts and re-entrench on the south bank of the Danube. Anyone left in Dacia would be on their own. Some, living lives far closer to their, quote, barbarian enemies than their Roman neighbors, did indeed stay put, but most everyone else packed up and headed south. When the order finally came to remove the Roman troops, a collection of Goths was ready and waiting to move in. Their migration into Dacia came with the approval of Aurelian, who worked out a deal involving trade rights and certain other concessions in exchange for these new Dacian Goths to agree to act as a military buffer to other Germanic tribes. The new frontier line was thus not only shorter and easier to defend, but it came equipped with a buffer zone that absorbed the brunt of many a potential invasion force. The evacuation of Dacia was as sound a policy as Rome had seen in a long time, but there was no mistaking the fact that good old Terminus, the implacable Roman god of boundaries, who, once planted, refused to be moved, had now been moved. That did not bode well for the future. Probably because he was not totally insensible to the optics of abandoning a fully incorporated province, Aurelian carved out of Moesia a new province, which he dubbed Dacia. Now, he could plausibly argue that he had not abandoned Dacia so much as moved it south of the Danube. See? There it is right there on the map. Okay, maybe he couldn't plausibly argue that, but it is worth noting that a province called Dacia still existed after Trajan's territory had been abandoned. The main point, though, was that while a Dacia still existed, the old Dacia was now gone. It had long been a backdoor into the empire, exploited endlessly by Rome's enemies, and Aurelian had now locked that door. Rome was safer and more secure for his decision. With walls being built around the cities of the empire and the long Danube frontier now left far more manageable, Aurelian could finally turn body and soul to his divinely ordained mission. Aurelian's priority list in 271 looked like this. Number 1, retake Egypt. Number 2, reassert Roman control over the rest of the eastern provinces. And 3, knock Palmyra down a peg or 5. His own army was too cumbersome to quickly deal with the first priority, so Aurelian ordered one of his officers, possibly the future Emperor Probus, to gather up a fleet and sail immediately for Alexandria. With luck, Probus, or whoever it actually was, there are good reasons to believe Probus was actually in Gaul through this whole period, would be able to land in Egypt and drive off the Palmyrene garrison before Aurelian even set foot in Syria to handle the business of priority number 2. Once Egypt was retaken, the imperial army could focus all of its energy on regaining control of Syria. Priority 3 would then be a foregone conclusion. The preparations underway in the imperial camp did not pass unnoticed by Zenobia. Knowing that Aurelian was likely coming no matter what her next move was, the Palmyrene queen decided to go all in, abandoning any pretense of partnership with Rome and issuing coins and orders under the auspices of Vibolithus alone, who was now styled, finally, Augustus. The Palmyrene court then advanced to Emesa, where Zenobia set up a forward base from which to confront Aurelian when he emerged into Syria. With a little luck, the cities of Asia Minor that she had recently brought into the Palmyrene fold would stick with their new eastern benefactor and resist the advance of Aurelian, leading the Roman emperor to either become bogged down in profitless sieges or continue on without secure supply or communication lines back to the west. Either outcome would have worked out to the Palmyrene advantage, and it would hopefully be a much worn-down Roman army that Zenobia and Zabdis would have to face. But Aurelian, as I think I've mentioned, was a no-nonsense kind of guy. He had no time for prolonged sieges, and no intention of continuing without ensuring that all of Anatolia was subdued. So, much to Zenobia's chagrin, Aurelian picked a third option from the hat. Force the cities of Asia Minor to capitulate with minimal fighting, and then proceed safely and securely on to Syria. The further west you went, the looser the ties to Palmyra, and as Aurelian advanced east, the cities that he approached opened their gates without a fight. Aurelian had a fierce reputation, and there was very little doubt that should he be defied, that the emperor's wrath would be swift and deadly. Aurelian was well aware that his reputation was preceding him, and he used it to great effect, but to no greater effect than when he finally reached a city that attempted to hold out. Moving south towards the Cilician gates, the imperial army reached the city of Tyana. Closer now to the center of Palmyra's power, the leaders of Tyana made a calculated decision to hold out against Aurelian and hopefully find great rewards for themselves in a new Palmyrene empire. But resisting Aurelian and enduring a prolonged siege was not on the to-do list of everyone in Tyana, and the city was quickly betrayed into Aurelian's hands. Everyone held their breath. Here was a city that had essentially spit in the face of Rome. How bloody was Aurelian's retribution going to be? The soldiers prepared to do some serious sacking. The citizens prepared to endure some serious sacking. But Aurelian emerged from his tent, and to the surprise of everyone, announced that there would be no reprisals, no sacking, no punishments. Instead, a general pardon was declared. According to the official legend, Aurelian had been visited in a dream by Apollonius, the famous philosophical son of Tyana, who, by the 3rd century, was being put forward as a sort of pagan answer to the growing cult of Jesus Christ. According to the legend, on the eve of Tyana's capitulation, Apollonius visited Aurelian and told the emperor that if he desired to rule, that he must abstain from shedding the blood of innocents, and that if he planned to conquer, he must also plan to be merciful. Whether it was the ghost of a dead philosopher or the shrewd mind of Aurelian that led Tyana to be spared, the decision was a masterstroke. Further east, the leading men of the cities that had gone over solidly to Palmyra had rightly feared punishment at the hands of Aurelian, but the example of Tyana proved that the emperor was in a forgiving mood. As the imperial army continued southeast, cities that would have resisted out of a desperate belief that they were doomed one way or the other now threw open their gates. Each city was given the same light treatment, compounding a wave of capitulation that led Aurelian all the way to the doorstep of Antioch. The emperor's surprised decision to play off type led not just to a far easier campaign for his legions, but also it laid the groundwork for an amicable return of the eastern provinces into the Roman fold. Aurelian wanted to reunify the empire. Laying terrible waste to the countryside might allow him to occupy the east, but it would unify nothing. As the emperor continued his march, word came up from Egypt that the fleet he had dispatched to retake Alexandria had landed and easily expelled the Palmyrene garrison, meaning that priority one was already now checked off the list. Watching her recently won political gains melt away, an undeterred Zenobia prepared for war, deploying Zabdis and the Palmyrene army between Aurelian and Antioch. Now, the Palmyrene army, especially the cataphracts, their much-vaunted armored cavalry, was a force to be reckoned with in any situation. But fighting on their home turf against legionaries not used to combat in the heat of the desert appeared to make them invincible. But Aurelian was a master strategist and tactician, and he had a plan to defeat the Palmyrenes and troops who were disciplined enough to pull it off. After a few days maneuvering around Antioch, Aurelian and Zabdis finally met in battle in May or June of 272. Knowing that defeating the cataphracts was the key to victory, Aurelian employed the same ruse Claudius had used against the Goths at Nisus, a ruse Aurelian knew the devastating effects of firsthand, as he had been the general leading the cavalry that day. While the infantry on both sides shuffled their feet, Aurelian ordered his cavalry to directly attack the cataphracts. At a prearranged moment, the Roman cavalry suddenly broke apart and began to flee from the field. With the Roman horsemen retreating in what appeared to be a panic, the Palmyrene cataphracts gave chase, smugly convinced that they were about to secure their own legend by crushing the cream of the Roman legions. But you know what comes next. After leading the cataphracts on a merry chase that wore out the heavily armored Palmyrenes, the Roman cavalry wheeled around at a second prearranged moment, and as one unit barreled straight into the surprised and exhausted cataphracts, devastating their ranks and allowing only a few to escape with their lives. As soon as Zabdis learned the fate of his armored cavalry, he knew that the battle was lost. His infantry was no match for the Roman infantry, and wasting little time, Zabdis ordered a retreat back to Antioch. Inside the city, panic gripped the local leaders, who had, rashly they now realized, thrown their lot in with the enemies of Rome. Aurelian had thus far displayed almost supernatural clemency, but who knew how long that was going to hold out. Nervous as they were, though, the city fathers figured that as long as the Palmyrene army was there to protect them, that there was still hope. Which is why they were mortified to wake up on the morning after the battle to find that Zabdis, recognizing the inevitability of Antioch's fall, had packed up and marched his army in the direction of Emesa in the middle of the night. Aurelian entered Antioch unchallenged, and was greeted by a citizen body prepared for the worst. But again, Aurelian proved to be of a much higher mind than anyone gave him credit for. Another general pardon was issued, and Syria was back in Roman hands. With priority 1 already accomplished and priority 2 well in hand, all that was left was priority 3, the crushing of Palmyra. Aurelian lingered in Antioch for a few weeks, waiting on reinforcements to ensure that he would only have to make one trip into the desert. And when they finally arrived, the emperor headed northeast to the city of Emesa, where Zenobia and Zabdis were holed up with the Palmyrene royal treasury and an army 70,000 strong. The significance of the coming battle, nor the significance of the coming battle site, were missed. Though it seemed like a lifetime ago, only 12 years had elapsed since Valerian had walked out to meet his fate on the same plains beside Emesa. Would Aurelian exorcise Rome's demons, or would the desert city become known to history as the slayer of emperors? In the battle that followed, Aurelian once again attempted to lure the Palmyrenes out with a fake retreat. But this time, his lines came too close to the Palmyrenes, and the chase was over before it got going. The Roman ranks, infantry and cavalry alike, were soon engulfed in bloody confusion. But the less disciplined Palmyrenes pushed their advantage too hard, which led to a breakup of their line, a breakup which was exploited to deadly effect by the Romans. First flanking and then surrounding the Palmyrenes, slaughter ensued. Zabdis and a few officers escaped back to the city, where they collected Zenobia and the rest of the royal family and dashed back to the relative safety of Palmyra. There was not even time to collect the treasury, which was music to the ears of the cash-strapped Aurelian. The rest was foregone conclusion. Aurelian secured the Palmyrene treasury and then followed his enemies back to their home city. Still defiant, Palmyra refused to yield just yet, and Aurelian was forced to begin a siege in the middle of the desert in the middle of summer. Now, being the oasis city that it was, Palmyra was well situated to hold out against the Romans and their dicey supply lines, but that was just in the near term. Long term, Zenobia recognized that they were going to need help if they wanted to get out of their fight with Rome alive. The only place they could possibly turn to for help, though, was, awkwardly, the Sassanids. The Persians were not likely to have forgotten that Odoacer had brought Palmyra to power by defeating and humiliating them. But in her desperation, Zenobia felt that she had no choice but to turn to them for aid. Unfortunately for the Palmyrenes, though, Sharpur, the great king who had captured an emperor and sacked Antioch, was dying, and the Sassanids were divided and distracted by the question of who was going to succeed him. Under different circumstances, the Persians might have decided to go to war for Palmyra, but right now, it was out of the question. Zenobia, though, could not afford to take no for an answer, so she decided to risk everything by traveling to the Sassanid capital and making her case in person. By risking everything, though, she wound up losing everything. Aurelian was alerted to the fact that the queen had slipped out of the city and was heading east. A Roman cavalry detachment quickly caught up and overtook the Palmyrenes, and Zenobia, the eastern queen who very nearly made herself the equal of a Roman emperor, was now his prisoner. The rank and file of the legions clamored for her death, but Aurelian would have none of it. After a generation of bad news, Aurelian was finally putting together a record the Romans could celebrate, and he planned to let them celebrate his victories with a good old-fashioned triumph. And what was a triumph without Rome's enemies marched through the streets of the Eternal City in chains? Back inside Palmyra, news of the Queen's capture sparked a brief fight between moderates and diehards about whether to capitulate. The war-weary moderates quickly suppressed the diehards, and the gates of the city were opened. As he had done for the entirety of his eastern campaign, Aurelian showed restraint when dealing with the citizens of Palmyra, announcing that there would be no bloody reprisals for their breach of faith. Unlike the cities of the empire proper, though, this time Aurelian allowed his men, who had thus far been denied any real spoils, a nice, organized sacking of the rich oasis city in the desert. And of course, the Palmyrene high command could not be treated as lightly as the leaders of Antioch or Tyana. After a brief public trial, the leaders of Palmyra, including Zabdis, were put to death. The fate of Vibolithus is unknown, though by one account he's going to die on the trip to Rome. But he's not very important anyway. Zenobia was the real prize, and Aurelian had her. With the eastern half of the empire now back under Roman control, Aurelian could turn to the west. The dream of a reunited empire was still only half fulfilled, and next week, Aurelian will turn his full attention on the Gallic Empire. The death of Postumus had left the western provinces without a strong leader, and Aurelian reckoned that capturing Gaul would be a whole lot easier than recapturing Syria. And he was right. I want to close this week by letting you all know that the History of Rome has apparently been nominated for a podcast award. We are in the running for Best Educational Podcast of 2010, and the award will be decided by an internet vote. So I figure that if every one of you takes a second to go to podcastawards.com, that again, podcastawards.com, and vote for us, then we have a pretty good shot at me forever after referring to the History of Rome as award-winning podcast, The History of Rome. Kind of like the way Pabst has gotten so much mileage out of that one blue ribbon they won that one time. You can vote once a day, so feel free to go crazy, and let's win this thing. I also want to mention that the final nominees were selected based on the number of nominations each show got, which means that some of you out there took the time and effort to talk the show up, submit our name, and get us nominated. Thank you very much. And dare I say it? Yes, I think I will. It's an honor just to be nominated. Podcastawards.com. Go vote for us. Hello, and welcome to the History of Rome, Episode 119, Restitutor Orbis. After a grueling march across the empire and an even more grueling summer campaign in the desert, Aurelian finally defeated Palmyra and captured Queen Zenobia in late 272 AD. Under different circumstances, a victory of this magnitude might have earned the emperor a rest from his labors, but no such luck. No sooner had Palmyra fallen than messengers arrived with the news that the Carpi, a Germanic tribe situated north of the Danube, had taken advantage of the emperor's eastern campaign and were now flooding down into Moesia and Thrace. Leaving behind a garrison under the command of a lieutenant named Marcellinus, the indefatigable Aurelian gathered up his equally indefatigable army and marched back to the Danube. An emperor's work is never done. Once Aurelian had left Palmyra, though, some of the leaders of the defeated city began to regret their surrender. Apparently, the ambitions of these leading citizens was only stifled when the emperor was right there on top of them. Now that he wasn't around, it was time to go back to dreaming about an independent Palmyrene kingdom again. These leading men quickly joined in a conspiracy that centered around Zenobia's youngest son, still basically an infant, but the best they could do on short notice. The men of Palmyra grew bold enough in their plans that they actually approached Marcellinus, the Roman garrison commander, offering him great rewards if he and his men joined their cause. The savvy Marcellinus told the Palmyrenes that this was a very tempting offer and that he would surely take some time to think the matter through fully. The Palmyrenes left thinking that a nudge in the right direction is all it would take to flip Marcellinus. Marcellinus left thinking that he better send a message to Aurelian right away so that the emperor could come back and crush these ungrateful wretches. Aurelian was engaged along the Danube in an operation that required the presence of the imperial army, but not much more than that, when he received the note from Marcellinus about the conspiracy. The garrison commander assured Aurelian that he had bought the emperor some time by pretending to consider joining the revolt, but that his little game would not play forever. Aurelian sighed, packed up his army, and marched back to Palmyra, in a foul mood. Under the impression that the emperor was far away and fully engaged with a Germanic invasion, the Palmyrenes showed themselves to be simultaneously overconfident and ill-prepared. While they lackadaisically got ready for war, they made contact with allies in Alexandria and induced a faction there to revolt in advance of the new Palmyrene offensive, which they all thought they had plenty of time to prepare for. It came as a mortal shock to everyone then, perhaps even Marcellinus himself, when Aurelian and his army appeared on the horizon right at the beginning of spring 273. A half-hearted effort was made to defend Palmyra, but nothing was in place and no one was ready. Aurelian took the city without a fight and once again marched in as its conqueror. As in his previous conquest, Aurelian showed himself unwilling to engage in a bloody free-for-all, and after executing everyone associated with the revolt, he let the rest of the citizens live, but he didn't leave them much to live with. This time, the emperor's clemency extended to living things only, and he ordered his men to level the city. A few of the more important religious buildings were left untouched and still sit in the Syrian desert to this day, but the rest of the city was destroyed. Aurelian had no intention of making this trip to the desert a third time. To further guarantee this, the emperor rerouted all east-west trade routes so that they bypassed the city, leaving Palmyra economically and existentially strangled. Its citizens drifted off as refugees to start new lives in new towns, and the great oasis city in the desert was no more. Aurelian then turned on Alexandria and quickly brought an end to the revolt there that had neither the men nor the resources to actually work without Palmyrene assistance. As with Palmyra, Aurelian did not take kindly to the Alexandrians revolting again so soon after being bought back into the Roman fold. He let his men off the leash and allowed them to plunder the city with savage abandon. It was during this punitive sacking that the royal quarter, which either contained or had contained the Library of Alexandria, was burned to the ground, leading some to lay the destruction of that great storehouse of knowledge at Aurelian's feet. But the jury is still out on when the library was actually destroyed, and probably will remain so until we invent ourselves a time machine. With clemency having brought most of the East back into the fold, and cold-hearted brutality bringing the rest into line, Aurelian's career east of the Hellespont was over. By the end of 273, he was back in Rome, attending to long-put-off civil matters, but more importantly, working up a plan to reconquer the Gallic provinces, a reconquest he could now finally turn his full attention to. The leaders of the Gallic Empire had been granted a stay of execution by Aurelian's preoccupation with the East, but with the emperor back in Italy, they knew it would not be long before he turned his fearsome attention on their little slice of the empire. That he did not celebrate a triumph for his victory over Palmyra was all the men of the Gallic Empire needed to know about Aurelian's intentions. Why throw two small triumphs when you can throw one great big one to celebrate full reunification? When last we left the Gallic Empire in 270, Postumus was dead, and a man by the name of Victorinus had risen to take his place as Emperor of the West. Victorinus successfully saw the Gallic Empire transition from the personal domain of Postumus into a freestanding political entity, albeit one that had shed the Iberian Peninsula in the process. Victorinus vigorously pursued the Rhine defenses, just as Postumus had, and spent the majority of his time in office battling back the Franks on the lower half of the river. But though he had the loyalty of the army and the government, Victorinus's conduct in private earned him personal enemies, and it was these personal enemies who eventually took him down. The conventional story is that Victorinus made advances on the wife of one of his officers, and that as soon as he had the opportunity, the officer in question assassinated the lecherous emperor. The story may or may not be true, as jilted underlings is a standard trope of ancient literature, but whatever the reason, Victorinus was killed in 271, leaving the Gallic Empire leaderless once again. Rising up to fill the void was a man named Eusebius Tetricus, who was likely a provincial governor at the time. Possibly with the backing of Victorinus's mother Victoria, whose bank accounts had bought the throne for her son, Tetricus was quickly installed and the Gallic Empire was put back on firm footing. I say possibly with the backing of Victorinus's mother because there is reason to doubt her existence at all. God, I love the 3rd century. Tetricus was not a weak ruler or a weak man, but the future course of his career has tended to leave him with a reputation as something of a coward. For 3 years, though, he held the remaining provinces of the Gallic Empire together and enjoyed the support of the Rhine legions, whom he led to victory against the Franks on more than one occasion. But by the opening of 274, Tetricus found himself facing a serious problem. Aurelian was back in Rome plotting his downfall, and his friends and advisors were beginning to think seriously about the future. With a fatalist mood beginning to take hold, the governor of Belgica, a man named Faustinus, revolted and seized Tetricus' capital of Trier while the Gallic emperor was in the south attempting to regain the territory that had been previously lost during the reign of Claudius Gothicus. Tetricus led his army back up north, and Faustinus quickly gave up his bid for power. Knowing full well the fate of Postumus, Tetricus allowed his men to sack Trier, even though it was the emperor's own capital. In both psychological and material value, the sacking of the Gallic capital was bad news for the Gallic Empire. Aurelian could not have cared less about Tetricus's problems. Fully united or internally fractured, the Gallic Empire was going down. As soon as the campaign season of 274 opened for business, Aurelian was on the move north. Operating out of the beachhead in the Rhone Valley established during the reign of Claudius, Aurelian quickly secured the surrender of any town, city, or individual he met, while Tetricus and the Rhine army attempted to find a suitable position from which to face Aurelian when the final showdown came. The suitable position they decided on were the plains outside of Chalon in what is now northeastern France, and in due course, Aurelian and his army progressed up to meet them. It is difficult to say for sure what happened next. There are some reports, and some evidence to back the claim, that a full-on battle was fought between the Imperial Army and the Rhine legions, and that after a bloody, vicious day, Aurelian captured Tetricus, which decisively turned the tide in Rome's favor. But the more familiar legend has it that Tetricus and Aurelian worked out a deal prior to the battle. Knowing he could not withstand Aurelian's invasion, Tetricus would line up his men for battle, and then, right before the fighting began, he promised to surrender himself to Aurelian. In exchange for this bloodless victory, Tetricus and his son would be allowed to live. A third tradition maintains that both the prearranged surrender and the bloody battle took place, but the only way this last version makes sense is if you believe the Rhine legions decided to carry on the fight without a leader, which seems impractical to the point of unbelievability. Or you could believe that Aurelian forced the Rhine legions to fight him as punishment for their transgressions or something. But the loss of perfectly useful manpower this revenge battle would have entailed seems like it would have been too much for Aurelian to justify. So I reckon either there was no deal and Tetricus led his men into battle and lost, or there was a deal and no battle followed. Pick your poison. Either way, Tetricus fell into Aurelian's hands, and the Gallic Empire, independent for 14 years now, was dissolved. Following his standard MO, Aurelian tempered his iron will with a generous spirit when dealing with the defeated Gallic provinces. He wanted reintegration to proceed as quickly and seamlessly as possible, so he undertook no post-war purges, and for the most part, left magistrates appointed by the Gallic emperors in place. Resumes posted on grave markers attest to the ease with which service in the Gallic Empire was recognized as a valid step up the career ladder in the now reunified empire. The only major change Aurelian made was to relocate the main Gallic mint from the far-off and repeatedly seditious city of Trier to the city of Lyon in southern Gaul, where it could be better controlled. This move was also undertaken as a part of Aurelian's wider fiscal reforms, which he could now implement fully across the empire. We have already seen that Aurelian took the matter of coin valuation very, very seriously, and you'll recall that the mint riots in Rome were caused by resistance to the reforms Aurelian was planning to make to the system. Without any sophisticated knowledge of how economics worked, Aurelian did not tackle the big problem of inflation, which was just beginning to make itself known, but he had a deep understanding of the problem of coin devaluation, and particularly of the effects it had on the army. Keeping the troops paid and paid on time was the key to everything, and if the imperial mint kept spitting out worthless hunks of metal, then the empire was going to have a very big problem on its hands very soon. The problem as Aurelian saw it was twofold. First, official imperial policy was ordering debasement, and second, there was very little oversight over the local mints. A related problem was where the mints were geographically located. With just a few main coining centers, problems at one location caused issues across multiple provinces and potentially affected hundreds of thousands of soldiers. So, following Gallienus's lead, Aurelian further multiplied the number of mints across the empire, basically giving each major garrison its own mint. At the same time, he centralized the coining bureaucracy and put the entire operation under the auspices of an imperial agent, answerable directly to the emperor. The days of local operators producing coins of dubious value were now at an end. With these changes in place, Aurelian could then do something like order the silver content of a standard denarius to be raised to 5% and feel confident that his orders would be carried out. Aurelian's stabilization of the currency system turned back the tide of the worst effects of debasement. But as I just hinted, it did nothing to help with the problem of inflation, a problem which was likely exacerbated by the proliferation of new coining centers. Inflation would be left to his successors to deal with, and boy, will they have fun with that one. But how much can you ask of one man? Aurelian's legacy was secure. He had reunited the empire, and that was how his contemporaries planned to remember him. With the Palmyrene and Gallic empires defeated and Rome's dominance reasserted over all her previous domains, well, except for poor old Dacia, Aurelian returned to Rome in triumph and, well, threw himself a triumph. Zenobia and Tetricus were the star attractions, and the two defeated monarchs were led through the streets in chains. But they were not the only stars. Exotic prisoners from the east were also on full display, as was the abundant wealth and treasure stolen from the defeated Palmyrenes. These were heady days for the jubilant Romans. For the past few decades, their empire without end had looked a lot like it was going to end. But now, Aurelian marched through the streets of the Eternal City as one of the greatest heroes in Roman history. This Illyrian general had given them back their empire. In gratitude, The Senate vowed him the grandiose but not at all undeserved title, Restitutor Orbis, the Restorer of the World. This new title was often combined with the further adjective Invictus, which turned Aurelian into the unconquered Restorer of the World. Again, grandiose, but again, not at all undeserved. Aurelian was well aware that his now 4 years in office had been nothing less than a string of complete and unqualified successes. Apart from the one minor setback against the Jathungi outside Placentia at the outset of his reign, Aurelian was undefeated in the field and had accomplished all that he had set out to do. While no doubt recognizing that his own native talents were to be credited, success of this kind in the ancient world usually called for recognition of something more. The classical world, as you may know, was awash in patron deities who were believed to ensure good ends for their mortal clients. We need look no further than the divine aid Apollo granted Augustus throughout the first emperor's providential career to understand the archetype we're talking about. There was no question that Aurelian was being protected by a powerful deity. The only question is which of the literally hundreds to choose from did Aurelian attribute his victories? The answer, helpfully, speaks to the larger religious transformation going on in the Mediterranean world during the shift into late antiquity. After following convention and identifying himself with Jupiter early in his reign, at some point, most likely during the campaign against the Palmyrenes, Aurelian began to believe that he was in fact the tool of something much bigger, Sol Invictus, the unconquered sun, an overarching solar deity who came to serve as an important link in the ancient world's transition from polytheism to monotheism. Now, an overarching solar deity has already made an appearance in the history of Rome during the confused and doomed reign of Elagabalus. Like Elagabalus, Aurelian came to believe that Sol really was the one true god, and that all other gods were inferior. But unlike Elagabalus, Aurelian did not attempt to suppress traditional pagan religion with his kooky new theological conceptions. Aurelian saw no incompatibility between his own budding monotheism and the wider world of pagan polytheism. He paid studious attention to Jupiter and Mars and Apollo and all the other usual suspects, but with the understanding that these old gods were actually just the forms that the one true god used to manifest itself on the mortal plane. To thank his great benefactor, Aurelian established a new temple in Rome dedicated to Sol Invictus, and initiated a new priesthood dedicated to its worship. While he made no attempt to hinder any other religious activities, Aurelian, in word and deed, made it clear that he considered Sol to be the most important of all the gods, indeed, the one true god, and encouraged its worship wherever he went. In this, he was engaged not just in religious zeal, but also in a wider socio-political project he hoped would help reconnect the so recently fractured empire. From Spain to Syria and from Britain to Africa, the citizens of the empire worshipped a huge variety of gods and goddesses who often bore little resemblance to one another. Aurelian hoped to provide everyone with a single manifest god to whom they could all equally worship. The natives of Gaul and, say, the natives of Carthage worship their own particular gods in their own particular ways. But if, at some point during each day, they turn their attention to the great overarching Sol Invictus, then the ties that bound the far-flung corners of the empire together would be immeasurably strengthened. That was the idea, anyway. And it was an idea whose time was coming. Constantine's vision of one empire and one church was in many ways foreshadowed by Aurelian's promulgation of the cult of Sol Invictus. And indeed, this earlier promulgation made the later transition to Christianity that much easier, as Jesus Christ was eventually identified with the sun god. So, if you were comfortable with worshiping Sol Invictus, then the shift to worshiping Jesus Christ became almost seamless. The last note I'll make about Aurelian's worship of the sun is that it was largely through his efforts that the Feast of the Unconquered Sun, which usually took place around December 25th, firmly took root on the Roman holiday calendar. And you should all remember from the History of Rome Christmas special that this feast was eventually claimed by the Church Fathers as the official birthday of Jesus, and is the reason we celebrate Christmas on the day that we do. It's worth noting that the switcheroo from Sol to Jesus didn't strike anyone as being too out of the blue, since, as I just mentioned, Jesus had already been firmly identified with the sun god. The unconquered restorer of the world, with the backing of the powerful Sol Invictus, next turned his attention on one of the few loose ends that had been left hanging in the past 4 years' whirlwind of activity. 14 years ago, the king of Sassanid Persia had taken the noble emperor Valerian prisoner by means of a dirty trick. Then he had forced Valerian to submit to all manner of humiliation and torture before the good emperor was finally allowed to die. His body, allegedly, still sat stuffed in the Sassanid throne room. If the Persians thought that all of this was going to be forgiven and forgotten, then they had another thing coming. Shortly after his defeat of Palmyra, word came west that the great King Sharpur had finally died. His death was a mixed bag for the Romans. On the one hand, it meant that they would not be able to exact revenge on Sharpur personally. But on the other hand, it meant that the Sassanids were now dealing with a succession crisis and were divided and weak. Now would be the perfect time to kick them while they were down and take revenge for the capture of Valerian. Aurelian was not going to let this opportunity pass. Remaining in Rome for the winter, Aurelian made plans for an invasion of Persia, and in the spring of 275 set out east with his army, intent on avenging Rome's honor. He would never make it past Thrace. By far the most capable emperor since Septimius Severus, and really one of the most capable emperors ever, was cut down in the prime of his life by misguided assassins who immediately regretted their rash murder. As you can probably imagine, the stern and humorless Aurelian had very little patience for corruption and double dealing, especially within his own staff. One of his personal secretaries had apparently lied his head off to the emperor about some random issue or another, and had either already been found out, or was about to be found out, and, terrified that he was going to be executed, he forged a document that purported to be a death list drawn up by the emperor with numerous high-ranking officers marked down for execution. This weaselly advisor then showed it to the high-ranking officers and let them take care of the rest. All these men knew Aurelian to be a strict and remorseless disciplinarian, and in the heat of the moment, they became convinced that if they didn't strike first, that Aurelian was going to kill them all, and unjustly at that. Encamped in Thrace in September or October of 275, the officers surprised Aurelian in his tent and stabbed him to death. Aurelian was 60 years old and had ruled the empire for 5 magnificent years. The rank and file were horrified to discover that their great general, the greatest that they had ever known, was dead, and the officers themselves were horrified when they discovered shortly thereafter that the whole thing had been a trick. The secretary, I can promise you, did not come to a quick or a painless end. So, just when it looked like everything was going to be okay, the empire was suddenly thrown into its own succession crisis. Only this time, the crisis did not unfold as a battle between men vying to put their own man on the throne, but instead as a battle between men who were trying to foist the question of who would rule now onto someone else. Next week, we will watch the amusing spectacle of the Senate and the Imperial Army, who had fought each other for so long over the right to nominate emperors, each now trying to get the other to pick a new leader for Rome. Hello, and welcome to the award-winning podcast, The History of Rome. Episode 120, Interregnum. So, yeah, we won the podcast award for Best Educational Podcast of 2010. Totally cool. There is no way that I can claim any sort of sole ownership of the honor, because it was you guys out there who nominated the show, and then you guys who went and voted for it. So I consider this a win for everyone in the History of Rome community. I didn't win anything, but we just won Best Educational Podcast of 2010. Congratulations. Aurelian's assassination in late 275 AD came as a shock to everyone, and apart from a few irreconcilables in the Senate, the unconquered restorer of the world was mourned throughout the empire. The rank and file of the imperial army, still camped in Thrace, was especially grief-stricken, and their grief soon turned to anger. They wanted to know who was behind the assassination, and then they wanted them dead. It was this bloodthirsty anger that led the senior officers of the legions, most of whom had been in on the murder, to take the unprecedented step of punting on the question of succession. Normally under these circumstances, one of them would have been put forward and acclaimed, but in this climate, imperial ambition would have been taken as evidence of guilt. What I mean by that is that the 3rd century assassinations preceding Aurelian's, those of Alexander Severus and Maximinus Thrax, and Philip the Arab, and Gallus, and Aemilianus, and Gallienus, were carried out with at least the tacit approval of the common soldiers, who understood that their erstwhile leaders needed to be pitched overboard, usually to save their own skins. But this business with Aurelian was a different animal altogether. He was popular, he was successful, and he faced no charismatic rival for power. He had, after all, already dispatched all of those. His death was not viewed with relief or indifference or hope, but with anger. To come forward and claim the purple, then, looked like a quick way to get fingered for Aurelian's murder and then get lynched by an angry mob. So the senior staff decided the safest course of action would be to ask the Senate to vote on a new emperor. That way, none of them would look like they had killed Aurelian out of crass ambition. So a few weeks after the emperor died, official envoys from the army arrived in Rome and announced to the Senate that the men of the legions humbly put the choice of Aurelian's successor into the hands of that great and ancient body. The Senate, of course, thought that this was insane. As much as they liked to whine about it, they had learned not to mess with the army on the issue of succession. The Senate's guys always got killed, and the men who put them forward usually got killed too. So, the Senate told the envoys, thanks, but no thanks. Then the envoys went back to the army, but the officers again refused to nominate one of their own, and kicked it back to the Senate. Things went on like this for a while, though exactly how long is a matter of long-standing debate. Famously, among others, the Historia Augusta reports that the interregnum lasted for a good 6 months, during which time neither side was willing to blink. In this telling, the Senate took over the day-to-day functions of the empire, while everyone waited for someone else to make the decision about who ought to be emperor. It has also been postulated that the emperor's widow, a practically unknown woman named Servina, actually wielded some kind of executive authority in her role as the Augusta during this period. But mostly, it seems like the whole notion of an extended interregnum only arises because of confusion in the ancient sources. There is no doubt that the soldiers and the Senate each tried to get the other to make the call, and that eventually, the Senate blinked and elevated a man named Marcus Claudius Tacitus. But the 6-month time frame appears to come from the fact that some 4th century historians completely dismissed the short reigns of Tacitus and his successor half-brother Florian, merely noting that 6 months passed between the death of Aurelian and the ascension of his successor, the general Probus. Later authors then picked this up and accidentally combined it with the story of the Senate and army arguing about who ought to follow Aurelian, and turned it into an interregnum of 6 months where there was no emperor at all, which doesn't really seem plausible. So I'm inclined to believe that Tacitus was elevated in December of 275, after one solid go-around between the army and the Senate. This shortens the interregnum to the period it took the envoys to go from Thrace to Rome, from Rome back to Thrace, and then back to Rome again. By that point, the Senate was ready to make the call, and they chose, as I just said, Marcus Claudius Tacitus, a man about whom we know almost nothing. Despite his tantalizing name, it does not appear that Emperor Tacitus was in any way related to the historian Tacitus, though that was a myth that was bandied about for quite a while. He is also described as being in his mid-70s at the time of his ascension, but again, that seems more myth than reality, something to gin up his credentials as the wise old sage of the Senate, a characterization which fit nicely into later historians' attempt to make his brief reign out to be the last great flash of senatorial relevance, before it was snuffed out completely by Diocletian and his Tetrarchy. Tacitus, whoever he was, however old he was, and whatever his agenda was in Campania when he heard that the Senate had chosen him for this great and terrible honor, and he quickly rode up to Rome to take his place on the throne. He allegedly gave a fine speech promising to renew the old partnership between emperor and senate, that the great conscript fathers of Rome would once again share in the burdens and responsibilities of empire, turning back the clock to a simpler and better time, etc., 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 blah, blah, blah. Then he rode off to Thrace to take command of the army. The stay of execution the officers behind Aurelian's murder had earned by punting the succession question to the Senate was canceled the minute Tacitus arrived in camp. Immediately taking note of the rank-and-file's still vengeful mood, Tacitus rounded up all the conspirators he could identify and ordered them killed. The bloodlust of the troops thus mollified, Tacitus announced that the march to Persia was now on indefinite hold. A swarm of German tribes north of the Danube had taken the news of Aurelian's death as an open invitation to recommence their raids on Roman territory, and the countryside was once again littered with barbarians. The imperial army spent the next 6 months engaged in a happy little game of whack-a-mole, as Tacitus attempted to impress upon the German tribes that Aurelian's death did not mean that Rome was suddenly some weakling who could be pushed around. And it was true. Of all Aurelian's legacies, perhaps the most important was the highly trained, highly disciplined veteran army he bequeathed to his successors. The legions of the imperial army were now as formidable a force as the empire had ever put together. And for the moment, there was no one on earth who could beat them in battle. A lesson the opportunistic Germans would soon learn. But Tacitus would not remain in command of this great army for long. Forced down into Cilicia to deal with some runaway intruders in the summer of 276, the emperor either succumbed to an illness or was assassinated by his own soldiers, who perhaps regretted allowing the Senate to decide their fate for them. He was supposedly 76 years old and had ruled the empire for just 6 months. So, like I say, the 6 months that Tacitus reigned correspond so nicely with the six-month interregnum between Aurelian and his successor that tales of an extended power vacuum really do seem misplaced. There was a six-month gap between Aurelian and the ascension of the man who could be considered his true successor, but that did not mean that there was a six-month gap between Aurelian and any successor at all. The man who can be considered Aurelian's true successor was, if you can believe this, an Illyrian general by the name of Marcus Aurelius Probus, who at the time was serving as commander-in-chief of the eastern provinces, a post so critical that it is easy to imagine that the childless Aurelian was grooming Probus to succeed him all along, though there is no hard evidence to support that one way or the other. Probus was of a slightly younger generation of officers than Claudius Gothicus and Aurelian had been, born around 232, rather than his elder colleagues, 213 and 215 AD, respectively. He came up in the army then, just as Valerian was taking power, and was eventually catapulted into the upper ranks of the officer corps when his Illyrian brethren seized control of the empire in 268. He served as one of Aurelian's key lieutenants, and as I said a few episodes back, he has traditionally been credited with the recapture of Egypt during the Palmyrene War, though other evidence points to his remaining in the west during that period, laying the groundwork for the Gallic War. Once the empire was reunited, though, Probus was definitely put in charge of all the armed forces in the east, a promotion that found him overseeing the all-important reintegration of the eastern provinces into the imperial fold. This posting alone speaks to the confidence that Aurelian must have had in his younger colleague. Only in his early 40s when Aurelian died, it is likely that Probus did not yet feel secure enough or strong enough to make his own bid for the throne. So, whatever his long-term ambitions might have been, this time around, he simply allowed the Senate and the army in Thrace to hash things out. But when Tacitus died in mid-276, most of the men senior to him in the chain of command were already dead as a result of the part that they had played in Aurelian's murder. By virtue of his eastern command and the esteem that the still-beloved Aurelian had obviously held him in, Probus was now a natural choice for the job of emperor, and the men under his command did not hesitate to hail him as such. Probus immediately began to march west to cement his claim to power. In a poetic repeat of the circumstances surrounding Aurelian's elevation 6 years earlier, before Probus could secure the throne outright, he had to deal with a counterclaim by the dead emperor's brother. Marcus Aeneas Florianus, the maternal half-brother of Tacitus, had been named Praetorian Prefect when Tacitus donned the purple, and was on hand when his brother died in Cilicia. With the imperial army leaderless, and imperial blood now coursing through his veins, Florian did not hesitate to assume the mantle of emperor at the first opportunity. The Senate was never consulted in any of this. Their brief return to the forefront of politics was already becoming a distant memory. From here on out, individual senators, by virtue of their private control of so much of the empire's land, might hold sway in government, but as an institution, the Senate was dead, dead, dead. Florian decided to immediately march his larger and better-trained army east to knock Probus out quickly, but he did not take into account the bonds that had formed between the soldiers of the now, quote-unquote, opposing armies over the course of their years fighting together under Aurelian. Most especially, he did not take into account that Probus was seen by everyone as the logical successor to Aurelian. The soldiers under his command likely didn't know Florian from Adam, but they knew Probus very well. A battle was not even necessary to decide the issue. No one was going to fight Probus. 88 days after being proclaimed emperor, Florian was either assassinated by his men or he committed suicide, and Marcus Aurelius Probus became the undisputed master of the empire, one of the last men, incidentally, to hold that particular distinction. Rome, as you may already know, is about to go through a fairly momentous transformation. Probus took over the reins of power in 276, and would rule until 282, a six-year stretch that, added to the 5 years of Aurelian's reign, combined to provide some much-needed stability to the empire. Unfortunately for us, though, the reign of Probus is like a poster child for the jumbled and confused chronology of the 3rd century. One of our main literary sources, a 4th century history by Aurelius Victor, cuts out right as he is about to go into detail about the reign of the good and decent Emperor Probus. So what we have to go on are some summaries, some snippets, and some coins. Not really the stuff that great history is made of, but we're going to do our best. It appears, first of all, that the Danube tribes were not the only ones to take Aurelian's death as an invitation to resume their attack on the provinces. Sending the army that had first declared him emperor back to Syria to garrison the east, Probus took command of the main imperial army and likely marched over to the Rhine frontier, where the Alemanni and the Franks had broken across the border. Well, I guess they didn't really break across so much as they just walked on over, seeing as how the old fortification lines developed by Domitian and Hadrian had been pretty well abandoned by this point. Archaeological excavations have shown that going into the crisis years, the Romans still manned and patrolled the same Limes Germanicus that they had for more than a century. But by the time the Gallic Empire was reintegrated, all but a handful of the old forts had been abandoned. As I mentioned during the first Aurelian episode, the Romans had by this point fallen back to their newly fortified cities as the main defensive line. There were simply too many Germans moving in too coordinated a way to make manning a long wall made of turf and wood a viable defensive option. In the coming years, first Diocletian and then Constantine will completely reshape the Roman military posture to account for the new threats that the empire faced. But for now, the transition was just getting started, and Probus had to rely on walled cities, a mobile imperial army, and a lot of luck to help him push back the German invaders. Although, following Aurelian's lead, Probus was not 100% intent on pushing the Germans out of the empire. What he really wanted was peace and stability on the frontiers. And, in their own way, this is what the Franks and Alemanni wanted too. So as he campaigned against them in the late 270s, it became standard policy to settle defeated tribesmen in the lands that had been vacated by the long Romanized Gauls, who had fled to the cities in the face of near-constant invasion. Tens of thousands of Germans were thus settled on provincial land, giving the economy a boost, the legions new recruits, and the provinces a nice buffer zone between unpacified tribes and the Roman interior. Sometimes it took defeating the Germans to get them into Roman settlements, but other times they requested permission to migrate. Permission that was granted on the condition that they disarm, disperse into smaller groups, and recognize the overarching authority of Roman officials, which seemed like a fine bargain for most of them, who welcomed the opportunity to share in the splendid riches of an empire they had for so long eyed with jealousy. For now, the process of Germanic integration was a gangbuster strategy for the recovering empire, and for the next 100 years, it worked out almost universally to the Roman advantage. Once the Huns got going, though, the whole ballgame would change, as the empire would have to deal with the settlement not of tens of thousands, but rather hundreds of thousands. And after Adrianople, it had to deal with hundreds of thousands who wanted settlement lands, but were no longer prepared to disperse or disarm. The West's inability to adjust to that new reality was one of the key reasons why, 100 years after that, the whole thing fell apart. But that is for another day. After pacifying the Rhine frontier, Probus then seems to have turned his attention back to the Danube, where he squared off and soundly defeated the Vandals. By this point, around about the early 280s, we begin to see a curious new sight. Soldiers engaged in public works and land restoration projects, which could only mean one thing. After nearly 50 years of constant warfare, the legions were running out of enemies to fight. Just a decade before, Aurelian had been unable to spare a single soldier to help build his walls around Rome. Walls that were finished right at the outset of Probus's reign, I should mention. But now, we have reports of soldiers digging irrigation ditches and planting vines, and yes, working on better fortifications for the provincial cities. The Sassanids were a significantly less potent threat now that Shapur was dead. The Goths had been beaten down to the point where they would not be a significant adversary for another century, and the power of the Franks and the Alemanni was being siphoned into the Roman tank. On the home front, sporadic uprisings were being choked off with ease, and for the briefest of moments, it seemed like the empire was at something resembling peace. It is even reported that Probus boasted that in a few years, Rome would not even need her armies anymore. Proud words, not to be taken literally, but unfortunately, it seems that some men in the army did take the emperor at his word, and they weren't too happy about Probus's vision of a less martial future. But don't get them wrong, they were no more interested in perpetual warfare than anyone else, but it's just that, well, if Rome no longer needs her armies, then they're all out of a job. And they liked their jobs. They were well paid and well fed, and had a degree of prestige that the poor provincial lives they had all left behind simply could not offer. That they were already doing back-breaking manual labor at Probus's order certainly did not bode well for their particular futures. That is, there wasn't much separating them from the civilians anymore. And according to the limited information we have, it was just this combination of unease about the future and annoyance with Probus's public works projects that led to the emperor's downfall in late 282. One of the main legionary garrisons in Probus's hometown of Sirmium had finally had enough of ditch digging in late 282, and throwing down their shovels, they rose up in revolt. It is difficult to follow the chain of events, but it seems that Probus had been in Rome celebrating a triumph, and that he was on his way back to the frontier zone, possibly to get Aurelian's planned eastern campaign restarted, when news of the revolt reached him. Eventually, the troops in Sirmium would elevate a praetorian prefect by the name of Marcus Aurelius Carus to the throne, but it is unclear whether this occurred in conjunction with the original revolt, or whether it only occurred after Probus had been dispatched with. The bottom line, though, is that Probus arrived in Sirmium to restore order, found himself overwhelmed by the unruly troops, and was assassinated in September or October of 282 AD. He was 50 years old and had ruled the empire for just about 6 years. The murder of Probus, like the murder of Aurelian, was committed in the heat of the moment, and as soon as things calmed down, the soldiers came to regret their hasty violence. Carus, now donning the purple, had no trouble rooting out the men behind the assassination, nor any pushback from the rest of the men when he executed the murderers. The deaths of these two great Illyrian generals really served no useful purpose for the empire. They were neither tyrants nor incompetents. Quite the opposite, they were capable administrators and brilliant soldiers who had done the yeoman's work pulling Rome from the depths of its misfortune. History cannot be rewritten, but with both men being as young as they were when they became emperor, it is not hard to imagine that had either one of them been allowed to rule into old age, that we might be dating the end of the crisis years to their ascension. As it stands, though, we still have a little ways to go. Though, with the elevation of Carus, we have basically come to the end of the line. The new emperor is going to elevate both his sons, Carinus and Numerian, to serve alongside him, and then he will march east to initiate the long-put-off campaign against the Sassanids. While on campaign, he is going to die, and shortly thereafter, his son Numerian is going to die. And then, a general named Diocles will be elevated to the throne, and we can once and for all put the whole sordid 3rd century crisis behind us. Next time, we will close out the crisis of the 3rd century and bring to power Diocletian, the man whose passion for stability and order will lead him to overhaul the entire administrative structure of the empire, transforming it in ways that no man since Augustus had even dreamed of attempting. To say nothing of the fact that in a very short time there will not be one emperor, but 4, and not rivals for power, but colleagues, working in concert to ensure the safety, survival, and prosperity of the renewed Roman Empire. I say next time rather than next week, because the Feast of the Unconquered Sun fast approaches, and the new year follows fast after that. I'll be traveling for the holidays and won't be able to get much writing done, so I'm going to have to take the next 2 weeks off. We'll be back, though, on January 9 to finally bury the crisis of the 3rd century and then launch into the new age of the Tetrarchy and then into Constantine and his newly minted Christian Empire.